Hello, I'm Sophie Grove, and this is The Big Interview on Monocle 24, our one-on-one show where people with fascinating lives, enviable careers, and plenty of great tales sit down and tell us how they got here today, and what inspires them, what makes them tick. My guest today is Amanda Levite, one of Britain's most interesting, innovative architects. Born to a dancer mother and a merchant banker father in Bridgend, Wales, she admits to being a rebellious soul at school, but found her calling at London's Architectural Association, where she trained under the likes of Archigram founder David Green and Nigel Coates. A stint working for Richard Rogers followed before she joined the firebrand Czech architect Jan Kaplicki as a partner, and later his wife, in the practice Future Systems. The pair picked up a slew of awards for their work, notably the Sterling Prize for the Lords Media Centre in London. In 2009, Amanda founded ALA, now a 55-strong practice with a diverse, experimental and inventive ethos. The team is working on a museum in Lisbon, a mosque in Abu Dhabi, and a £41 million extension scheme for the Victoria and Albert Museum, which features the world's first porcelain courtyard. Though high profile, Amanda's work is research-led, subtle, and even discreet. Her approach is arguably ushering in a new era for building in a post-Starkitect world. And she joins me now in the studio at Midori House in London. Amanda, welcome to Midori House. It's very lovely to see you today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Great to catch up. Actually, not so long ago, I was stomping around one of your amazing projects down at the V&A, hard hat on. We've got you in the studio. I wanted to start, well, at the very beginning. Really, what drew the young Amanda towards the craft, the profession of architecture? Can you tell me about your early influences?
I came from a slightly different angle, if you like. So I left school at 16, which was quite unusual. And I went straight to art school to do a foundation. And I thought, you know, I want to be an artist. And while I was there, I was just a little bit embarrassed about not taking A-levels. So I started doing a lot of reading about the history of art with a view to taking an A-level. And it was through reading about history of art and seeing architecture in the context of whether it was Renaissance Italy or early European modernism that I kind of began to understand architecture's role in forming civilizations, in forming society. And it felt to me it kind of embodied everything that I valued in life. And yet it had these very real boundaries. And I'm somebody who works best when there's a kind of boundary to push against. And I kind of thought, well, you know, this is it. This is architecture. And I then discovered the AA. And the AA, if you like, was very much in the kind of atelier motives. It's like a glorified art school. It still is. And I thought that was perfectly suited to my sensibility. So I started at the AA when I was 18. And I had a great time, and it was at a moment when the AA was the hotbed of the most radical thinking, the most interesting ideas, a very kind of conceptual approach to architecture. And the teachers there were extraordinary and have gone on to become, you know, some of the most significant figures of our time. So there was Zaha Hadid, there was Rem Koolhaas, there was Daniel Libeskind, Nigel Coates, Bernard Tschumi, Leon Krier. It was a fantastic hothouse. Now, I wasn't taught directly by all of those people, but there was this sense of a kind of creative milieu and an energy that was quite extraordinary. And I think it doesn't exist in the same way now.
And how much did that prepare you for the work that you have done subsequently? I mean, one of the criticisms of the Architectural Association is it's so conceptual. When these sort of young radicals come out the other end, actually, can they build, or are they sort of firebrands? Are they really artists?
Well, they're definitely not artists, and I have a very kind of clear view that the sensibility of an architect is very different from that of an artist. But yes, in terms of being able to build when you come out of the AA, forget it, you can't. And I was one of those. And I spent a lot of my time at the AA resisting doing projects that involved building. So it was very conceptual. Any opportunity not to build was the kind of something that I seized on. However, now, as somebody who runs a practice, I have a very different view that while the architects that come out of the AA very skilled in conceptual thinking, in presenting their ideas, in articulating their ideas, and do the most exquisite drawings, they are no use as architects for, I would say, a year or 2 years. So we, you know, it feels sometimes that we're a little bit like a finishing school, that we are training people in what they should have learned at school. And I am quite critical now of the English architectural education system. However, what is interesting is that we, you know, our office is now, we're 55 people, and more than 50% come from non-British EU countries. And there's a reason for that. And the reason is that the education in Spain, in Italy, in Portugal, and, you know, to a degree in France, it's much more technical, but they don't have the same kind of fluency, perhaps, in conceptual thinking. So this diversity is really important. It's important for our office. It's important for the culture of architecture. So in Spain, for example, the students are not allowed to present their work to their tutors in person. Everything has to be in drawing form on the boards, and therefore their drawings are much more controlled and specific in communicating, but they are perhaps less good in presenting verbally. So it's a very interesting mix, but it's why it's very important for me that the borders are kept open, because without the influence from our kind of European educated architects, the office would be much less rich.
I wondered if you have any views on the sort of fiendishly difficult work ethic that you find in British architectural institutes, and actually it's for this idea of incredibly long hours for young architects. What was your initial experience coming from the Architectural Association out into the world of work and practices when you did graduate?
You know, the culture of architecture schools is a very hard working, it's a very intense, and the kind of culture of all-nighters is very much embedded into the way that students work. And it's a highly inefficient way of working, but there's a certain kind of culture and there's a certain kind of passion that comes out of pushing yourself physically and emotionally and technically to do these all-nighters. And then when I went into practice and I worked for Richard Rogers, yes, you know, there are, when you're doing a competition still, there is a kind of culture of doing all-nighters. And it can be a very bonding experience. It is a very inefficient way of working. And I think it's very important when you have a practice to help people and support people find a better work-life balance. And so, I mean, we pride ourselves on being a moderately efficient office, but we don't always get it right. But I think to set up a culture where it's okay to leave on time is very important. I mean, I think one of the things that I have found probably most difficult in running an office is establishing the culture of that office. It's probably more difficult than doing the architecture, and it takes time. But being supportive, being empathetic is a very, very important aspect.
Now, I'll take you back again to the early days of your career and setting up a young practice, which you did after you'd worked with Richard Rogers for a few years. Tell me what that was like. You went into partnership with your then husband, or a man who became your husband, a Czech architect, Jan Kaplicki, and you worked on some very formative projects, some quite radical projects. Tell me about that time of your life, that sort of balance, as you say, between productivity and this heady ambition and creativity.
Well, I joined Jan as a partner in 1989, and 2 weeks after I left Richard Rogers' office, we were shortlisted for the competition for the Bibliothèque de France. And that somehow, it kind of felt like a sign that everything was going to be okay. And we put everything into that competition. It was just the two of us. We actually temporarily imported somebody from Prague, who was a kind of protege of Jan's because the wall had recently fallen, and it was an opportunity to bring him over just to assist on that competition. And we got tantalizingly close. We came second, and it was a mortal blow when we lost that competition. However, the money we got from doing that competition, I think it was 20,000, it kept us going for a year. I mean, it was such a different time. So for a long time, it was just the two of us. And they were heady days, but there was absolutely no separation between work and life. It was one. We didn't take holidays. We had very little money. We worked 7 days a week. But that was our choice. We loved it. And very slowly, and it was a very slow trajectory, we started to build. And when we won the competition for the Media Centre at Lourdes, that was really our big breakthrough. And that, in a sense, that expressed many of the ideas and preoccupations that were Future Systems, and that also had been obsessing Jan for years before he even formed Future Systems. So it was a very important project. It was incredibly difficult to realise. We had, without realising it, we had designed the first all-aluminium building in the world. It was the first semi-monocoque structure in the world that was a building that wasn't a boat. It was using transfer technology from the boat industry. It was built by boat builders, not by construction workers. So there was a kind of litany of firsts, and it was the difficulty and the complexity of it was out of all proportion to the size. But it's a project that I remain incredibly proud of. I think we made real breakthroughs, and it was important.
And it was incredible, a benchmark for you as a practice, but also for architecture in Britain, as you say. But it was a financial risk as well. I mean, this is one thing that architects are dealing with. It was in those days sort of nearly £6 million of money that you were sort of investing as a practice. And I wondered, how did you balance that financial, well, all those challenges with the creative sort of identity of your practice? And also this idea of the bittersweet, you know, you had so many challenges with that building. You had so many successes with that building in terms of winning the Sterling Prize, for instance.
You know, the very nature of architecture is about risk-taking, because every building is, in a sense, bespoke. And with bespoke and the one-off comes risk. And yet there's a paradox that everybody wants that, but they want it to be risk-free, and it's just simply not possible. So it's about how do you manage those risks. And because we were so obsessed with this project, we managed to contain all those things, and with the engineers Arup to resolve the very challenging structural kind of hurdles that we put in front of ourselves, if you like. The risk that we hadn't really understood was the risk of simply focusing on this one project. And we believed that, you know, when it was finished, that everybody would want another one, that somehow the commissions would roll in. It didn't happen. And because we had focused on this building so closely and forgotten to look for other work, we were on the verge of bankruptcy at the end of that project. And had we not won the Sterling Prize, which also at that time came with a cheque of £20,000, we would probably have gone under.
It does seem like your practice is employing a whole new, a different philosophy than perhaps we've seen before in big cities like London.
I always kind of shy away from trying to define a philosophy, because I don't think it's kind of quite like that. But the way that we embark on a project is to interrogate its complexity, to understand the resistance that's there, whether it's the resistance of history, whether it's a technical resistance, and how you can use intuition, if you like, to kind of add depth and to add purpose and intent to what you do. And this sort of idea of making visible the Invisible has really played out, not just in the design, but in the kind of structural challenge. So we're digging down 15 metres within 1 metre of a Grade 1 listed building. I mean, that's brave, that's daring. That was daring of the V&A to commission us to do that. But in doing that, we have not only unlocked, I think, the potential of the site by going so close to it, by creating a greater kind of correspondence between history and modernity. But we have, and this wasn't something that we set out to do, we may have advanced engineering knowledge beyond what we were imagining. And that's because we're piling down 50 metres. And the reason we're going so deep is usually when you dig a big basement, you put a big superstructure, a skyscraper on top, but we've just got a courtyard. And so the slab has a tendency to want to float. So you have to pull it down with these deep, deep tension piles. And Cambridge University is so fascinated by this challenge, and they work closely with Arup, that they have, purely as a piece of research and at their own expense, installed fibre optic monitoring cables into the tension piles because they believe that the movements and uplift that will be recorded may actually disprove the elastic theory, which is the theory engineers use to make these calculations. And if that's the case, then we will have advanced knowledge.
Wow, it really is the scientific experiment. I was going to say, you know, at ALA, you really have, you've taken on this sort of strategic, intuitive, but very experimental approach with materials particularly. I mean, the word holistic is definitely overused, but it does apply to your practice because you tackle big projects like this beautiful porcelain courtyard, but also smaller restaurants, even the tin can. And then globally, a project like the Central Embassy in Bangkok. I wondered whether or not you could give an insight into how you go about choosing your forms, your inspiration. And a lot of people would sort of like to get behind the initial sort of creative process that goes into generating these buildings. Could you sort of unpick sort of how ALA works in that way?
In a way, you know, form for us is the result of the thinking, result of the questions that we ask ourselves, that we ask the client, that we ask of the site. It's a result of the research that we do. It's a result of the narrative that we develop to help drive a project, to help describe it. There's not a formula.
There's no sketch on the back of an envelope.
No, it doesn't. And I, you know, it really comes out of a much more complex line of inquiry. And so, you know, to give an example, the V&A and the structure of the roof of the gallery, which is this folded plate, comes out of, first of all, the technical challenge of spanning 38 metres, but also came out of a desire to want to express that challenge. So we could easily have created a white box or a black box without any expression to the ceiling, but that is not the nature of the V&A. The V&A is a very didactic institution. It's didactic in its mission, in its collection, and in its building, in the building itself. And we wanted to continue that tradition and to make the structure be explicit of the job it was doing, and then kind of follow in the tradition of the sort of ornate neoclassic, neo-Gothic ceilings, museological ceilings that is the V&A. And then something like the porcelain courtyard came about because we wanted to reflect that structure. We wanted to, for the courtyard to in some way be an expression of the kind of palpable energy of what was below. And that was a much more kind of finessed approach and wanting to explore materials and particularly porcelain, although we didn't set out to use porcelain, and then to somehow push a material to its limits and express that in the way that we've conceived of the courtyard.
It's an approach that seems not to involve too much kind of creative ego, and I wondered, it's very apt that you did take over the place of the spiral, this very strutting structure. I wonder whether that is anything to do with your approach as a person, and also the fact that you're a woman, that a different sort of idea of architecture. Would you attribute anything to that?
Well, maybe it's a little bit to do with my personality and loving working as a collaborative group of directors. I mean, all of us, and we've had this conversation, you know, I think if we were all working separately, we would be doing something slightly different. It's that kind of intersection that makes it so rich. And when we all agree on something, and we don't always, it's at that point that we think we've nailed it. It doesn't have anything to do with being a woman. I mean, I get asked this question a lot, as you can imagine. And I kind of rather hope that, you know, one of the many legacies that Zaha has left us is that we will stop talking about women architects and just talk about architects. I have three directors, one is a woman, two are men. We have a kind of 50-50 gender balance in the office. Fortunately, hasn't always been the case. I think having a gender balance is very important to the culture of an office. But, you know, is a woman's sensibility as an architect different from a man's? Probably not.
Nevertheless, there is a very male-dominated... Well, it's interesting that when Zaha Hadid sadly died recently, there was so much discussion about how few women architects, there really prominent women architects there are in Britain and globally, how she became a sort of somehow a figurehead for all women architects was a tragedy in itself. I wondered if there is something, perhaps the work ethic of the industry, perhaps a macho element that exists in the industry that you could pinpoint that you think is an explanation for this.
I mean, I think, you know, Zaha was in many senses she was a warrior. You know, she stepped out in front and she took the bullets and we all stood behind her. But I think in the last 10 years, it has really changed. I mean, first of all, Zaha was probably the most known architect in the world. She happened to be a woman. Things are changing. I was recently in a competition and more than 50% of the shortlisted practices were female-led. It's changing. It's changing internationally. The thing is that architecture is a very tough profession. It's very competitive. It's very demanding. It's a way of life. You can't, you know, that's why it's so difficult often to create a kind of a proper work-life balance. And you have to have a passion for what you do. And I think as a profession, as, you know, compared to the medical profession or the legal profession, we're not very good at making it easy for women to come back to work in an architect's office. Recently in my office, everybody seems to be getting pregnant. So we're working really very hard to set up a culture where it's really going to be easier. But it's not everybody wants to make certain sacrifices or make certain choices. And I think the sooner that the whole issue of childcare is accepted to be shared equally between men and women, this will be the kind of status quo. But it is changing, and I feel very positive about those changes. And there are, you know, some of the most talked about architects of the moment are women.
What do you think it was that drew you as a young woman towards the profession? Looking back, what is it that really gave you that ambition, that kernel of determination to tackle the craft and to do what you've done?
I mean, architecture, you know, it embodies so much of what it is to be human. It speaks of who we are, it speaks of our past, it speaks of kind of collective identity of nations. It changes the way that people interact. We can design places that change the way that people can meet, that encourage the unexpected, that encourage chance encounters. And we're part of creating the identity of who we are as a society and reflecting those values. And, you know, that's an unbelievably, it's a wonderful thing to be involved in. It's also a huge responsibility, but it covers so many areas, and that is what I love. It, you know, it's not, filmmaking is kind of the result of everything. It's all those other much bigger issues, which is what really really turns me on about architecture.
And is that something you would love to see, a better dialogue in society, this important social role of architecture and design? Sometimes it feels like there is a disconnect between the policy makers, the politicians and the architects, and even the architects and the developers. Is there a sense that there should be a much better dialogue there?
I think that politicians in Britain have never really got culture. They really haven't. You know, the fact that architecture is lumped in with media and sport, I mean, what's it got to do with sport? I think there's a lack of acknowledgement of the power of architecture as kind of cultural diplomacy, as part of the soft power of a country. You know, why do people travel to cities? Why do tourists come to places? Architecture is such a big part of it. And it's not just about the architecture of the past. It's about the architecture of tomorrow. It's about how the architecture reflects our society. And I don't know how you make politicians get culture, because for sure we've all been trying. But there's such an obsession with trying to measure value, trying to monetize things, to be able to say, you know, oh, the contribution it makes to the GDP. Well, of course it does, because, you know, to build a building, it takes a cast of thousands. And, you know, the offices who work at an international level, you're employing a lot of people. But, that, you know, that's just kind of obvious. That's not where the real value lies. The real value is something much more profound.
And in terms of that value, what projects do you think you would really love to work on next? What's next for ALA?
Well, I mean, I'm working on some of the projects that I've always dreamed of, the V&A, but the MAT, the Museum for Art, Architecture and Technology in Lisbon, which will open in October of this year, which again, there is a, I think politicians there do understand culture more, and it's very much a place of intersection. It's a very interesting financial model. It's a privately funded public building. And it's a place where we're creating public spaces that are as important as the gallery spaces, as a public space on the roof, which is going to screen movies against the backdrop of the old city. There's a public space of steps going down into the river, and the steps flood at high tide and add a kind of sparkle to the elevation. And then a competition that we won at the end of last year for Galerie Lafayette in Paris, you know, which is a very important icon for Parisians. And in a way, we've been tasked with trying to, through the remodeling that we'll do, to define the French art of living. But so interesting that a British-based practice has been tasked with that.
Well, Amanda, so much to look forward to, so many fascinating, beautiful spaces. It's wonderful to speak to you. Thank you very much for joining me on Monocle 24. You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Sophie Grove, in conversation with Amanda Levite. The Big Interview is produced by Bill Luty, researched by Gaia Lukes and Charlie Young, and edited by Nina Narek. Until next time, all that's left to say is goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.